Welcome back to 20VC with me, Harry Stebbings. Now, I just love doing this show today, a very real conversation about what truly great leadership means. And so with that, I'm thrilled to welcome Jose Neves, founder, CEO, and chairman at Farfetch, the number one destination for high-end fashion, offering the world's greatest selection of luxury. Now a public company, Jose has raised over $1.7 billion with Farfetch from some of the biggest names, including Alibaba, Richemont, JD.com, Index Ventures, and DST, to name a few. Prior to Farfetch, Jose has been involved in the fashion startup world since the mid-1990s when he launched footwear business Swear. Jose later founded Six London, a fashion licensing and wholesale company selling to 600 retailers worldwide. And finally, in 2001, Jose opened the renowned Boutique B store, which won the British Fashion Award for Retailer of the Year in 2006. And I'd also want to say huge thank you to Danny Reimer at Index, Frederick Kaur at Felix, and John Kamaluddin for some amazing question suggestions today. I really did so appreciate that. But before we dive into the show today, I have to say I just love using AngelList Fund Admin platform to manage my investments. The team at AngelList takes care of all my back office needs so that I can focus on working with great founders. Leading fund managers have made over 10,000 investments into 6,000 startups via AngelList, all online and all in one place. And with the recently announced rolling funds, you can easily find and invest in these top fund managers on angellist.com/rolling. And speaking of the incredible platform that is AngelList on the business side there, on the personal side, Harness is the next generation wealth management solution created for builders, individuals founding, scaling, and investing in businesses. And if you're like me and not ready for an ongoing advisory relationship, then simple. Schedule a 1-hour tax planning session with a tax advisor experienced in working with equity. The accountant will review your equity and tax documents, answer any questions you may have, and provide projections for potential equity decisions. But don't just take my word for it. Harness have helped founders and early employees at companies like Stripe, UiPath, Affirm, and Coinbase capture more value with their finances. Go to harnesswealth.com/the20minute VC to sign up. Plus, 20VC listeners can receive $100 off their first year fees when they sign up for an advisor on the Harness platform by entering the 20 minute VC08. And speaking of wealth management with Harness there, Masterworks is the first platform for buying and selling shares representing an investment in iconic artworks. Masterworks invite you to join an exclusive community investing in the most incredible blue chip art, so you can invest in multi-million dollar paintings, buy and sell shares on secondary markets, and then receive the proceeds when the painting sells. And with more than $150 million in paintings purchased, Masterworks is the top buyer in the art market. So it's time to build your diversified portfolio of expertly vetted works curated by industry-leading research with Masterworks. And you can find out more today at masterworks.io. But that's enough from me. I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did to record it. So I'm thrilled to welcome Jose Neves, founder, CEO, and chairman at Farfetch.
3, 2, 1, 0. You have now arrived at your destination.
Well, Jose, it's such a pleasure to have you on the show today. I've heard so many great things from the wonderful Mr. Danny Reimer. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. No, it's my pleasure, Harry. Congrats for the concept. And yeah, really happy to be part of this.
Well, that is very kind of you to say. But I want to start with a little bit of context. So, you know, we see Farfetch now, one of the largest and most successful tech companies to come out of Europe over the last decade or so. But I'd love to go back to the beginning in a little bit and just ask, where did it all start for you? And what was that aha moment?
I always say that the journey is now 27 years and counting, because I've always been an entrepreneur since the age of 19. I started as a software developer. Then I started my company with my current CTO, actually, Cipriano, who's been working with me for 27 years, bless him. And then we started developing software for the fashion industry. That made me fall in love with fashion. I became a shoe designer. I never stopped being a coder, and the software business carried on. And it was these two experiences that ultimately led to the concept behind Farfetch and this idea of a community of curators and creators united in one single easy-to-shop platform. But to me, it's like a continuum, right? It doesn't feel like I did one thing and then I stopped and then I did another thing and then I eventually decided to do Farfetch. It just feels, as I'm still doing what I always wanted to do, which I always had a passion for, what I call revolutionary technologies, things that change the way the world works somehow for the better, and a passion for fashion. And so to me, it feels like a continuum. And the Farfetch idea actually looks very, very simple to me. And it has always looked very simple. You know, this industry needs a platform. Someone has to build one. And we're going to have a go at it. It's what came to our minds in that winter of 2007.
Now, I always go off schedule, but I have to to touch on one thing you said there. You mentioned the partnership that you have, 27 years. I mean, Jose, it's longer than I've been alive. It's longer than most people are ever married for. Can I ask you, what's the essence of a partnership of such strength and quality like that, do you think?
Well, first of all, it just shows how old we are. I'm one of the oldest people going around in the far-fetched corridors. We don't go around in our corridors these days because of COVID, but we're going to go back one of these days. Yeah, I think it's a shared passion for the same thing. Cipriano has always been a revolutionary in spirit, and he loves new problems like any good coder. But he really loves creating products and things that really change the way people operate and do things and express their creativity. In our case, in the case of our industry, it's a creative industry. And that's really all we care about, right? And that's what kept us going all these years. And then mutual respect, obviously, and friendship. There's always the value of mutual trust, respect, and we just love working with each other. We love each other to bits.
It's lovely to hear about that relationship. Now, you mentioned also being the shoe designer, and in 1997, I know you launched your own fashion brand with Swear. What were the biggest takeaways from that experience? And also, how did that impact your operating mindset with Farfetch?
So I actually started Swear in 1995, and I moved to London in 1996 to open the Swear flagship store in Covent Garden. To call it a flagship store is a bit grandiose because it was literally 250 square feet. It was a hole in the wall, the tiniest store of Neal Street in Covent Garden. But for me, it was like a big step moving to the big city. I was born in a tiny city in Porto in Portugal, and moving to a global metropolis and developing my brand there. You know, it was a bit naive of me because I was only 22 at the time. You know, I had no education in shoe design, as you probably can tell from my early designs. And all I had learned was being in factories and watching the pattern cutters, and I actually trained as a pattern cutter. I found someone to teach me. But, you know, it wasn't a very prepared step in my life and in my journey. It was more of, I think I can do this kind of youthful arrogance, and that's it. But it was quite successful. We had a huge following globally. These were the days of the Spice Girls and the Chemical Brothers and Prodigy and all the cyberpunk kind of aesthetic. And therefore, Swear, which was very rebellious and very cyberpunk, well, it says it all, really caught the imagination of folks at the time. And we ended up having franchises, so Swear shops everywhere. We had a Swear shop in Moscow in front of the Kremlin in Nikolskaya Street. We had one in Hong Kong. We had one in Cape Town at the point. So we had quite an incredible success in the 4 or 5 years that followed that launch. So it was luck. Of course, fashion changed very drastically, and that's where I learned that it's a difficult business because it's a cyclical business in terms of trends. So one day platforms are hot, the other day they're not. And one day I woke up and platforms were not hot, and I didn't have a business anymore. And all the shops closed down, and we almost went bankrupt. So, you know, it's, if I go back, all of these experiences were super important because the concept behind Farfetch, the way Farfetch is structured with, for example, no fashion risk, no inventory risk, but also a risk-free channel that we make accessible to creatives like I was, to have a global audience without having to go and open stores everywhere. You know, all of these things are coming from learnings of my mistakes and things I've done in the past, and I saw other designers do in the past. How can I avoid those pitfalls? How can I make others avoid those pitfalls? And how can we create something that still keeps the magic of creativity and what makes this industry amazing, yet be a win-win for everyone involved and really foster business success ultimately.
Can I ask, before we dive into kind of you and your leadership, you know, I think when people look at you today, it's like this inevitable up and to the right success, and Jose has always just been incredibly successful. You mentioned that it not working out in the end and platforms not being in fashion or in vogue. How did you deal with it not working? It's incredibly painful when a business doesn't work. How did you personally deal with that?
I think it's a learning. I think being a CEO is one of the most humbling exercises in life. I'm not saying that every single job is a chance that life gives us to teach us some humility. But I think being a CEO, a founder, is a very lonely position, especially if you have no other founders. I never had a co-founder. I was always the only CEO and founder of my businesses. You have to decide impossible things, because if they were not impossible, others would have decided before, right? As the saying goes. And you have to decide with limited data and with a mix of gut feel and experience and intuition and right brain, left brain. And then you have to live with that decision. So when things don't go well, it is very sobering, and it brings you straight down to the ground if not below the ground sometimes. You know, after a while, you just get used to it and you start to see it's part of the journey. It's part of, you know, being hit, falling on the floor and get back on your feet again and get back in the fight again. And I think that's very important. I did martial arts, Japanese martial arts as a teenager, and my master always say it's more important to know how to fall than to know how to attack. To know how to fall and get up is the most important thing. And that's true in life as well and in businesses.
You mentioned the kind of takeaway, and I love that in terms of the saying from martial arts. You know, obviously I did my research before, and you said before that you're a Zen Buddhist by philosophy and not by religion. I've never had this on the show before, so I thought I'd take the chance. What element of Zen Buddhism philosophically resonates with you so much?
First of all, for me, having a philosophy is important because you need one. And even if you think you don't have one, you do have one. Maybe you're not conscious of it. Maybe you inherit it from your parents, or you inherit it from your society, culture, the role society has given you, and you never questioned it. But you are using it. As human beings, we cannot operate. Our minds are models of reality, and our actions are based on those models of reality. And therefore, you're either conscious that you're creating a model of reality and conscious of what that model is, and it is plastic, it is changing all the time, or you're not. So for me, that's why this is not just a hobby. It is essential to my life. It's really to try to be conscious of what my mind is doing, how it is processing reality. And that is a very Zen thing. You know, it's really about being here and now and being aware of what is arising and embracing what is arising. So whatever arises, love that. It's one of the Zen koans.
Can I ask, how do you practice that? Because I totally agree with you in terms of being aware, being in the moment, but it's very difficult with all the surrounding noise that one has. How does one do that? Is that meditation? Is that continuously bringing yourself back to the core? What does that look like for you in terms of putting that into practice?
It is meditation. The essence of meditation is awareness of the present moment. And that's why you can meditate in your Peloton, for example. I know you're a Peloton aficionado. As long as you are fully aware of the present moment, that means your bodily sensations, even the visceral sensations, it means your emotions and feelings, it means your thoughts, whether they're involuntary or voluntary. And as long as you're fully aware, and even aware that you are aware, you are in meditation. So if you ask a Zen master how many hours you meditate a day, he'll say all the time, 24. I'm far from being a Zen master, very, very far, for full disclosure. But it is that contemplative practice, really. And once you get the hang of it, you can do it all the time. You can absolutely do it all the time. And of course, you will lose track of it and you will get completely entangled in your thoughts and on your emotions. And when you have a situation in your life that really pushes the button, like we say, pushes your buttons, you just lose it. But the moment you recognize, oh, I lost it, I was completely unconscious of what I was doing. I was just in reaction mode and I was just automatic pilot. And I don't know what I said and what I said or did what I did. That moment just shows you that a part of you was present and was realizing that you were not present. Unless you live completely immersed in your own mind and you never do this exercise ever, and then you can go an entire lifetime without even noticing that you haven't noticed anything. But otherwise, it's perfectly okay to go in and out, right? And all of us can do this. It's interesting because the fact that we can ask ourselves, am I fully present now? And have an honest answer and say, well, no, I'm not fully present now. That means a part of us is fully present now. Do you know what I mean? So it is very natural. It's very human. It's very simple. And it's just a practice. It's just something that you practice every day. And after a while, you get the hang of it. And it doesn't mean you won't have any problems in your life. On the contrary, you probably will bring more things to surface in your life that you need to deal with. And it doesn't mean that you don't suffer. It doesn't mean that you don't go through emotional ups and downs. It just means that you enjoy them a little bit more. And that for me is really helpful. It has really helped me in my life, be it personal life, be it professional life. And it's exciting because you never know what's going to be next. That's the other thing. You cannot conceptualize it and grasp at it and create a mental picture of it. And this is it. And that is the state. And this is how you feel in that state. There's no such thing like that, right? It's completely unknown. So you're leaping into the unknown every single second. And that's exciting. Keeps life fresh, exciting, keeps energy flowing. It's just refreshing.
Can I ask, how do you balance that? Like leaping into the unknown, you never know what's coming. Also with Wall Street's desire to know what's coming, employee certainty to know what's coming. How do do you balance like the uncertainty of life and the inevitable with the expectations of Wall Street, employees, investors who want to know what's coming and want some certainty around it?
Well, it's the only way you can deal with all these things in an adequate and healthy manner. Last Friday, our stock was involved in one of the hedge fund blow-ups. Ark Eagles Capital blew up, and I woke up. I normally don't look at the stock price. I only looked at the stock price by 11, and the stock was down 20%. So what is happening? No one knew what was happening. And I said, okay, let's see if there's any news. There must be some news. No news. Okay, maybe the Nasdaq is down. No, Nasdaq is not down. It's not the tech. Well, okay, fine. So it's a bit strange, a bit weird. But at that moment, these things come back. These things, wow, here's the unknown. So the unknown is manifesting itself. It's just wake up on a Friday and a third of your company or a quarter, I don't know how much it was, is being dumped in the market. Okay, how do we deal with this? And then, of course, there's the things you do, right? You jump on a call with your CFO and you jump on a call with your investor relations. The bankers call you and they say what's happening on the floor. And you then start to see the news coming through. But if you don't have this detachment in the sense that this is just proof that you are not in control, you are absolutely not in control of life, not at all. And if you don't have that clarity and that humility that we don't have the power to control events in our life, we do have the power to control our reaction to those events. And in that lies our freedom. And so for me, actually, this philosophy helps me a lot because I didn't slit my wrists. And actually, I ended up Friday feeling super proud and so happy because we recovered. We only went down a few 2% or whatever it was, and we dropped 20% twice intraday, which means that investors have jumped in and bought the stock because they believed in the prospects of the business, even in a day where no one knew exactly what was going on. And for me, actually, I ended that day not, because that's the other thing, you know, if you don't have this outlook in life, you'll say life isn't fair, right? Which is a position many of us take sometimes, and we all take it, which is, oh, life is so unfair. Why am I one of the five stocks this guy in the other side of the world picked and was playing with? And why the, no, don't do that. It happened what happened. And actually, it's super positive. And that's the result of the hard work of my team, my investor relations team, the results we posted, the trust we've created in the market. And that's amazing. That's great. And we didn't know what was going to happen Monday because there was another bunch of stock that was going to be sold money. So we had a weekend where we, okay, Monday, maybe it opens again with 20% down and maybe it stays there or even plummets even further. We don't know. And that is fantastic because it gives you this serenity of dealing with the situations. And you just, the Buddhists, they say right action. Right action is just the action that is needed. Not more, not less. It's right action. And it comes from that space of peace. We're not in control. What can we learn from this? What is it that I need to do now? So that's where I look at it.
Can I ask, I love that you said the word detachment there. Bit of a personal question. Do you think the ability to detach comes from bluntly financial security? You know, Farfetch is obviously an incredibly successful company now, and you know, you've done very well with Farfetch. Do you think detachment comes with financial security? And how have you seen like your relationship to detachment change?
Detachment, let's call it serenity or peace, because detachment can sound aloof, can sound like I'm alienating myself, I don't care, there's a world out there. It's nothing like that. On the contrary, you're doing everything that needs to be done. You know, you're doing everything. You're picking up the phone, you're jumping on video calls, you're doing everything. You're not doing it with a sense of panic. You're doing it with a sense of serenity, of like, what is it within our power that we can do? I think that doesn't depend at all on external events. So it has nothing to do with the financial security. There are examples of stocks that did not recover, and there was no guarantee that ours was going to recover because it was quite a lot. I mean, the volumes, to give you an idea, were 10 times more or less the average volume. I think it was around 10% of the company was dumped on Friday and probably another 10% on Monday, something like that. So there was a huge concentrated position, and that could have led to minus 50%, minus 60%. I mean, that has happened before. And so if there's panic around the stock, no one buying it, and some people wanting to sell it at whatever cost, that's what happens, right? So I don't think it's financial security at all, because you can be in the safest position and create a mental movie, and that mental movie will will throw you into a panic situation, right? And we all experience that. Sometimes we're in a perfectly safe environment, but I mean, people are afraid of planes, I don't know. And you're a perfectly safe environment, statistically proven to be the safest mode of transportation. Everything's fine, but suddenly there's a thunderbolt or maybe turbulence, and that's it. And you're out of control. And your mind completely spiraling, creating mental movies of all the things you're going to leave behind and how horrible this that is going to be. Why did I board this bloody plane? So it's nothing to do with external factors. It has to really to do with internal factors. And I'm just a human being, so I'm as prone of being caught. It's just that, for example, in some situations, I'm not caught anymore, but I'm caught in others. So, you know, there will be other situations that push my buttons. And in those situations, I will freak out and I will lose it. And it's okay. It's just part of being human. And then you go back and say, wow, I really lost it. Great. You know, like, okay, there's still so much to learn. Let's carry on. Give me more.
Can I ask, you mentioned right action there as like a teaching. I'd love to hear, how do you think about following your head versus your heart when it comes to decision making? And any lessons you have from past experiences choosing head versus heart?
Yeah, so one of my favorite neuroscientists, I love neuroscience. I'm passionate about how the mind works. That's my, I would say it's a hobby, but it's not a hobby because it's so central in my life that it comes even before anything else. Because if I don't understand how my mind works, how can I make sense of the world anyway, in any circumstance? But I'm very much into neuroscience. And this guy, he happens to be Portuguese. He has a Hage Index of 99. He's a hugely published scientist. And he published his first seminal book, which was the Error of Descartes. And Descartes, philosopher, French philosopher, famously said, I think, therefore I am. And he thought that there was a clear division between rational thinking, logical thinking, and emotions. And he thought that emotions got in the middle. And this is such a big mistake. And we're taught this when we're children, either implicit or explicitly. We're taught by our parents, we're taught by our teachers in school, we're taught by documentaries or movies. And what he has proven, and this book was in 1994, it changed my life when I read it, that he's since then published. The last one I really recommend the listeners is The Strange Order of Things, the book he just published. And what he demonstrated is that you cannot make good decisions without involving your emotions. For example, people who have a stroke in the right hemisphere of the brain, they keep the left hemisphere. Left hemisphere is responsible for language, logical thinking, modeling, a lot of that stuff. The right-hand side is more the here and now, the emotions, the emotional map of what's going on. So when you are impaired in your right hemisphere, your left hemisphere can answer an IQ test perfectly well. You can do perfectly well at maths problems, but you don't function in society. And you make mistake after mistake after mistake, and you drive yourself to ruin. And he has some very poignant and shocking stories of patients that time and time again, researchers have written about these patients that lose the balance between emotions and reason. And in a social context, you just can't operate. What does that mean? It means that the answer, do you make decisions with your brain or you make decisions with your heart, is the incorrect question, because it just shows that you don't know how your mind works and how your heart works. Your heart is part of your nervous system. By the way, your gut is part of your nervous system, billions of nerve cells, and your entire body is part of your nervous system. For example, producing hormones in glands around your body that affect how the brain is perceiving reality at any given point. Those hormones are not produced in the brain. So we are better equipped to make the best decisions when we are in a state of serenity, which is a bodily state, when we are breathing in the right way, when our emotions are brought to the foreground and we're conscious of those emotions, and when you let them participate in the decision process. And you need to take a little bit of time, because this, you need to brood over it. And then what you have is what you mentioned early in this meeting, you have the aha moment. The aha moment is a very bodily moment, isn't it? You do feel it. It's like, aha. Right? And that's the moment where your left brain aligned with the right brain, aligned with your body, aligned with your heart. And that's also intuition, right? That's when intuitively you know, okay, this is the right track. I am down the right track. And this is never purely mental decision. And for me, this is very important. And we teach our executives how these things work. We have a leadership program and we have a value. And we have six values. One of them is be human. And I always say, guys, be human is not to be nice to all people all the time. That's not what be human is all about. Be human is about understanding how human beings work, how you work, how we make decisions, how we construct models of reality, and bring all of you into the decision, not just your left brain, not just what you learned in your previous job, not just what you read in the Harvard Business Review last weekend, or what's the latest trend, because everyone's doing that, you should also do it. And that's actually very poor quality. That's the conditioned mind. The conditioned mind normally comes up with really bad crap decisions all the time. So in the part of the equation, you shouldn't dismiss that. Experience is important and pattern recognition is important, all of that. Bring the rest, bring your gut, bring your heart, bring your breathing, bring your body, everything into, and other human beings, by the way, because they're so helpful, because they complement, they extend your capabilities, right? Into everything you do and into your decisions. So that's how I see it.
I think risk is such an integral part of decision-making models. When you think about your relationship to risk today, how do you think about that? And has that changed with the maturation of Farfetch into the very successful and public company today? And so how do you think about that relationship to risk for you?
That's a fascinating question, because entrepreneurs, they have a completely different risk calculator to other people, right? We would never start a business if we had the, you know, average person perception of risk. Because, I mean, if you look at startups, the majority does not survive, and it's a very small minority that is a home run or whatever you want to call it, like a huge success. And you're taking a huge personal risk. You're investing your passion, your energy, your ego, your security, your sense of security, your sense of certainty of outcome. You're putting all of that in the line, right, when you start a business. So we do have already a calculator that is messed up in the circuitry. The circuitry of our risk calculator is just wired in a different way. Then I think as you mature as an entrepreneur, you know, you start to be a little bit more nuanced. You start to be a little bit older. I'm turning 47 now. And your risk calculator calibration starts to be a little bit more average, a little bit more normal. And you do start to ascertain risks in a more understandable way, in more of an average way. But I think you always keep that. And it is very important to keep that. It's very important to keep that in the culture of the business, because businesses that don't take risks, they will die. It's just a matter of time. And in the tech space, they will die very, very quickly, because technology is changing at such a fast pace that you need to change. Any change is a risk you're taking. May work, may not work. You need to leave behind things that are cash cows, that are the core of your business. Not leave behind, but venture into other lines of business that are outside your comfort zone. So you need to keep having this risk appetite, actually, instead of risk aversion. Most people are risk averse. I think entrepreneurs are risk curious. So they like to play with the probabilities of success and failure, and they get a kick out of this game. So I think this is really important for businesses, not just for the founders and the CEOs and the executives, but for the entire culture of the firm is really important. We have another value that is be revolutionary at Farfetch, and that talks to that risk, to that constant reinvention of the business model and of ourselves.
I mean, I love that be revolutionary. It takes courage to be revolutionary in a lot of ways. And I think when you spoke about that, like, you know, moving away from core business models or starting up new lines of business that are inherently risky, I think for me, something that I struggle with a lot, actually, despite the posh British accent on the podcast, is self-doubt and like handling self-doubt as someone quite young in the industry, but doing things that are a little bit more older. How do you think about your relationship with self-doubt? And I guess, how would you advise me, who thinks about that self-doubt quite a lot?
I think self-doubt is healthy. So what would be a human being without self-doubt? Talking in more psychological terms, you know, the ego needs to inflate for us to do something. If you take a baby, the baby needs to believe that she can run. She's just walking barely, but she needs to believe that she can. That's the ego inflation, right? So her own mental picture of herself envisions her running around, and she needs to have that, because otherwise she won't try. Of course, she will fall, and that will be a painful experience. But this is so normal. So it is so normal that we do something and it works out, and then we say, wow, I can really do this. Maybe I can go a little faster. That you can call it ego inflation, which is totally fine. Otherwise, you don't get out of the same place. You're stuck in life. And of course, you will stretch yourself to a certain limit, and then you will fail, and then you will come back again. And this is how you grow, right? You grow through this cycle. So self-doubt is very healthy, as long as it doesn't cripple you, as long as you can have that detached view, again, that conscious view that, okay, wow, I'm doubting myself here. And as long as you can clearly see it for what it is a mental movie, it is a mental construct, it's your brain constructing what if all goes wrong. It's just a mental construct, that's all it is. It doesn't mean it will go wrong or right, or it's just a mental construct. And that gives you the other ability to say, if this is all a mental construct, let's do the opposite mental construct. What if it goes brilliantly? How does that look like? And you can actually tell your mind, okay, you gave me the negative scenario. Thank you very much. I really appreciate that. I love you. Now, mind, give me the positive scenario. Go. And the mind will give you the positive scenario. You can. You know you can give yourself the positive scenario. And if you look at both scenarios and say, both are mental movies, which one do I want to live by? I'd rather live with the positive one than with the negative one, right? Because then it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. I'm going to be miserable all the time. So I think self-doubt is great. I have self-doubt all the time, every single hour, and it's great. And I look at it and say, wow, that's great. You know, like there's so many things that can go wrong and I'm aware of it. And this is my mind protecting me. Great. Thank you, mind. Now give me the other scenario. Oh, okay, fine. Feel better now. Let's carry on.
When you have this self-doubt though, I think the hard thing with being the leader is that, as you said before, about the loneliness that comes with being the CEO, and inherent within every CEO-ship is that loneliness. How do you deal with that loneliness today?
Again, after a while, you get used to it. I have to say, I have an amazing, amazing team, right, left, and center. My exec team, the senior leaders at Farfetch, every single Farfetcher. This is the thing I'm most proud about, is the culture, the mission-driven, values-driven culture we've created, with a strong sense of purpose, with a strong sense of love for this amazing part of culture, which is fashion and revolutionary technology. And therefore, I don't feel that lonely anymore, because now I have my role, and in my role, I will have to make lonely decisions that at the end of the day, everyone, in certain cases, everyone will be looking at the room to one person, which is me, and say, and now what do we do? And that will be fundamentally a lonely decision. Then I just need to say, okay, this is my role. My role, my task, my job, I am paid for this. This is my job. I'm paid for sometimes being the person that has to make a decision when no one can decide, right? Can make a final decision of the company. Once you start looking at it as your job, it's quite meaningful then. Then it gives you a sense of purpose. It's also, okay, my company needs me, because every company need someone, could be me, could be some other person, but you need someone that will have that role. It's a job, right? It's a job. It's not more important or less important than any other job, but the job is to make the ultimate decision in a company and then assume the responsibilities, everything that comes with it. So you get used to it and then you see beauty in it in the end.
Can I ask one that's potentially divisive? When I spoke to some amazing people around you, they said so many wonderful things, and they said also one of your great strengths and weaknesses is you're maybe a little bit stubborn. How do you feel about your relationship to being stubborn? And is that a good thing, actually, in many ways?
I am very stubborn. It is one of my personality traits, which annoys a lot of people around me, starting with my wife and my kids and my colleagues. I do have a blind spot because I never worked for anyone, right? I started my business when I was 19, so I never worked for anyone. That gives me tons of blind spots. And being an entrepreneur and being hardened or battle scarred by ups and downs of being an entrepreneur, you know, it got a little better, but I'm still to learn how to be less stubborn. I think it is a shadow personality trait for sure. Totally admit it. I plead guilty.
I think the answer is just Sputnik. In all cases, listen to your wife. You can never go wrong.
Yes, I think that's such an important role she has. She pulls the plug on all the bullshit. She says, no, you're not going to get away with that one. No, come here. Okay. She's right. Okay, bless her.
Last question for you. And it's common Busquets before said that you're world class when it comes to rallying opposing parties around shared goals. What do you think gives you that talent, and how do you approach that careful discussion, negotiation, rallying parties together?
I don't know, really. I think it is the ethos of Farfetch, right? We see ourselves as an enabler for an entire industry. So what we really, really want to do, what is the reason why we wake up, come to work every day, go through thick and thin to make this company a success? And the ultimate reason is we love this industry and we love revolutionary technology. We do it for the love of fashion and revolutionary technology. We don't want to be a retailer. We don't want to be a designer. We're not any of those things. We are an enabler for the creative community to engage with the public that loves this part of culture, which is fashion. So when you think of Farfetch as that, as a platform, right, as a platform that brings the creatives and the curators, the boutiques, together with the brands, which are the creators, under one roof as a beautiful ecosystem and makes that available to people that are deeply engaged with this part of culture, which is fashion, the consumer, if you want. No one is an adversary of anyone, right? So I really see this as an ecosystem. For example, Louis Vuitton appointed Virgil Abloh as the men's creative director a few years ago to huge success. I think Virgil is revolutionizing the Louis Vuitton vision for men's. But guess what? That can only be possible because a boutique in Italy and Antonioli and also Davide, two co-founders of NGG, met Virgil. By then, he was working for Kanye West, believed in him and said, this guy has a great vision. And you know what? We're going to support him. We're going to put some money behind him, find some factories to produce his clothes and sell it in one single boutique in Milan. And from there, we, Farfetch, had that brand since day one, since season one. We sold $1,000 of white the first season, spring, summer 2014. We were able to tell all the other boutiques, guys, this brand is really hot. It's flying off the shelves, both online and offline. And we have that visibility into that data. That allowed Off-White to have 10 boutiques, 100 boutiques, 200 department stores, big retailers eventually stocking them, catches the eye of Louis Vuitton, who says, wow, he's cut his teeth already, right? He's done X number of collections. He's entered a number of categories. He's proven himself. And now he can be the creative director of Louis Vuitton. Everyone benefited. Everyone benefited. The boutiques benefited. Virgil benefited. Louis Vuitton benefited. Farfetch benefited. It's a win-win. So for us, bringing all these people together, I get a huge kick out of this because it's really for the love of fashion, for the love of the entire industry. So for us, it's easy then. The point of departure is this view of an ecosystem where there's a win-win-win. There's always a win-win-win. I think that's what makes the conversations possible. And that's what makes these deals between what seemingly are potential competitors possible, because we don't see them like that.
No, I love that. And I really like the win-win-win. I think it's so often portrayed that for someone to win, someone else has to lose, which I don't agree with at all. And so I think it's great to hear that. And I love the story of Virgil. That's awesome. Now, I do want to move into my favorite, Jose, which is the quick fire round. So I say a short statement and you give me your immediate thoughts. Does that sound okay?
Yeah, let's do this.
Okay, so what's the favorite book and why?
Favorite book is The Master and His Emissary, which is a book about the right brain and the left brain and how it shaped history and culture.
A little birdie tells me that you don't wear socks. So what's up with not wearing socks?
It's a trend from the early 2000s that I never shook off.
What three traits do you most want your children to adopt?
Humility, respect, and serenity.
What's the hardest thing about succeeding in China?
I think understanding the culture is really culture adaptation, I think, is in all senses.
How would you describe your relationship to money today?
Money is a token that you get from society to do something positive with it, whether it's in business or whether it's in your personal life. It's really a social token that you're given.
You've acquired some incredible companies. Integration is always a nightmare. How have you integrated so well, and what does successful integration look like to you?
I think it starts with culture and values and making sure that we get alignment with that and we get alignment with the vision of what is a win-win. And then it's really hard work after that.
Tell me, who's the best board member that you've worked with and why?
I'll pick David Rosenblatt. He's also the board of Twitter and IAC, and he's the CEO of First Tips. Before that, he sold his company to Google. So not just his incredible acumen and experience, but also the fact that he's been an entrepreneur. He's been one of us. So that always brings a different angle into the room.
Tell me, final one and the most exciting, what do the next 5 years hold for you and for Farfetch? Paint that picture for me.
We don't know is the short answer, but I think it's the convergence of physical and digital retail in a much more personalized and elevated experience.
Jose, this has been such a pleasure to do. I completely went off schedule, but I absolutely love the discussion. So thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, Harry.
I mean, I'm sure you could tell how much I absolutely love that discussion. I want to say a huge thank you to Jose for being so open in that discussion, though very rare to be able to have such a deep and honest conversation, quite frankly, on the show. But before we leave you today, I have to say, I just love using AngelList Fund Admin platform to manage my investments. The team at AngelList takes care of all my back office needs so that I can focus on working with great founders. Leading fund managers have made over 10,000 investments into 6,000 startups via AngelList, all online and all in one place. And with the recently announced rolling funds, you can easily find and invest in these top fund managers on angellist.com/rolling. And speaking of the incredible platform that is AngelList on the business side there, on the personal side, Harness is the next generation wealth management solution created for builders, individuals founding, scaling, and investing in businesses. And if you're like me and not ready for an ongoing advisory relationship, then simple. Schedule a 1-hour tax planning session with a tax advisor experienced in working with equity. The accountant will review your equity and tax documents, answer any questions you may have, and provide projections for potential equity decisions. But don't just take my word for it. Harness have helped founders and early employees at companies like Stripe, UiPath, Affirm, and Coinbase capture more value with their finances. Go to harnesswealth.com/the20minute VC to sign up. Plus, 20 VC listeners can receive $100 off their first year fees when they sign up for an advisor on the Harness platform by entering the 20 minute VC08. And speaking of wealth management with Harness there, Masterworks is the first platform for buying and selling shares, representing an investment in iconic artworks. Masterworks invite you to join an exclusive community investing in the most incredible blue chip art, so you can invest in multi-million dollar paintings, buy and sell shares on secondary markets, and then receive the proceeds when the painting sells. And with more than $150 million in paintings purchased, Masterworks is the top buyer in the art market. So it's time to build your diversified portfolio of expertly vetted works curated by industry-leading research with Masterworks. And you can find out more today at masterworks.io. As always, I so appreciate all your support, and I can't wait to bring you an incredible episode with Devon at Insight on Thursday.